This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Evolution is the most majestic problem-solving force on the planet, but it also creates problems. Take the Suriname toad. After an undersea mating ritual that involves copious somersaults, the fertilized eggs are deposited on the female's back. The mama frog's skin grows around them, protecting her progeny from predators until they emerge en masse in a way that Wired science writer Matt Simon describes as a not-okay thing for humans to witness. Humans can witness a parade of eccentric life forms that have not perished, but adapted in remarkable and bizarre ways in Matt's new book, The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Most Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems. You could call it The Survival of the Weirdest. And Matt Simon joins us now with more. Matt, welcome to Word of Mouth.
And thank you for having me.
Well, in the book, you write that evolution creates many problems, but also finds many solutions. There's this constant push, pull, churning and churning onward. And out of this comes absurd creatures?
Yes, very, very many of them. And there are so many problems in this world that I think you and I probably take for granted as humans that have largely removed ourselves from the food chain. A lot of these critters are battling not only predators, but parasites that are trying to inject them with their eggs, which is an unfortunate way to go through life. But when you get these solutions to certain problems, other creatures actually fight back with their own evolution. So you get kind of this push and pull of problem and solution and problem and solution. You get some very, very unique adaptations in the animal kingdom.
So throughout, they're just pursuing life. And you say that you know the meaning of life.
I do.
We finally arrived.
I'd hate to spoil this for everybody, but I figured it out on my own. No big deal. And I started the book out this way. The meaning of life is to get laid. It is to pass down your genes at any cost. And I open the book with a particular creature that does this in a unique way. Its name is Antechinus, and it's a marsupial from Australia, of course. What it does is it has a 2-week breeding season, which happens to be pretty short. So what the males have to do is mate with as many females as they possibly can in that 2 weeks. What happens is they don't really sleep, they don't eat. So eventually their bodies start reacting badly to that. They will lose their fur. They will bleed internally, which is unfortunate. And some of them will actually go blind toward the end, but still they're running around trying to find that last female. At the end of the breeding season, every single male will have perished from having too much sex. It sounds like not a solution at face value. It sounds like a problem in and of itself. But again, this is the meaning of life, passing down your genes at any cost. It doesn't matter if he survives that breeding season, because ideally his genes will pass on to the next generation if he has done his job properly.
Maybe we should revise that thing of calling a particularly randy male a dog or a pig and an Antechinus.
Exactly.
Should become the new word. But where's the female in all of this?
So you would think that she's losing out pretty badly here. That sounds unfortunate, but at the end of the breeding season, again, all of the males are dead. That leaves her with a forest with tons and tons of insects. And that's important for a marsupial in particular because her young are born very underdeveloped. She has to produce a lot of milk and very nutritious milk to be able to feed them. And indeed, what seems to have happened over evolutionary time is females have actually shortened the breeding season to time with this abundance of insects in the spring. That left the males with only 2 weeks to do their business. At the end of the 2 weeks, they're dead. The females have all these insects, and they're better able to raise those young in the absence of any males.
This is the Darwinian principle of transmutation, right? You have as many progeny as possible, and some of them will have a chance of making it.
Exactly. Yeah, Darwin used the word transmutation. He actually shied away from the word evolution because it implied some progress. Evolution is not about progress. It's about creatures that are best fitted to their environment. We are humans. We have these great big brains, but that doesn't make us any better adapted than something like Antechinus that is going about life its own way.
Okay, so I want to get to the creatures involved in your title here, The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar. And I'm seeing it as Glyptopantales wasp?
That's right.
So what is their advantage here? What is their push or pull?
Yeah, so insects aren't exactly known for their mothering instincts. It's more about laying the eggs and leaving and letting the young raise themselves. Really, there are a couple of exceptions to that, but for the most part, insects do that. The Glyptopantales wasp goes about things rather more brutally. It adopts a babysitter for its young in the sense that it will find a caterpillar and inject it with as many as 80 eggs. Those eggs hatch inside the caterpillar and devour its insides, but are careful to avoid the vital organs to keep their host alive. After a little while, they will have developed into these nice little maggots that will then erupt en masse out of the caterpillar all at once, so you will have 80 of these things coming out of this poor caterpillar at one time. Amazingly, what is happening is these larvae, as they're developing, they're shedding their skin to grow a little bit bigger, and they actually time their last shedding with their egress, they call it, from the caterpillar. That actually plugs up the wound in the caterpillar's flesh. That keeps the caterpillar alive. And what happens next is something straight out of science fiction. It seems that two or three of the larvae will stay behind in the caterpillar and release some sort of chemical that starts controlling its brain. The brothers and sisters that have come out of the caterpillar will spin their cocoons, and the caterpillar will actually stick around and spin its own silk over those cocoons, which is odd because you would think it would have some sort of hard feelings toward these creatures that just erupted from its body. But it will not feed, it won't move, it'll sit right on top of those eggs and protect them at any cost. It will fling its head around violently to bash away any of their parasites that might want to intrude, which is, again, very strange for something that was just assaulted by these little parasites. But it's a kind of an emerging field, and it's very widespread, this idea of parasitic manipulation of behavior. You get this across the animal kingdom in a bunch of different lineages, but it makes perfect sense because the wasp mother needs some way to protect her kids. And to do that, she enlists this hapless caterpillar that, unfortunately, after it has spun that silk over the eggs and protected them for a little while, once those eggs hatch into little baby wasps, they will fly away, and the caterpillar will unceremoniously starve to death.
Okay, so I'm thinking one for wasps, zero for the caterpillar there. But you write that a species may gain an edge, but any sort of edge gets answered. Okay, so what's the edge here for the caterpillar? I mean, why are they still alive if this happens to them?
This is not so much one of those examples. The caterpillar loses out pretty badly here. It hasn't evolved any sort of defense against this, but you might expect that this could eventually maybe come up at some point where the caterpillar, this one particular caterpillar, was born with some sort of resistance to this chemical release of the larvae, right? But that hasn't happened. You get this kind of push and pull between parasites and hosts in the animal kingdom, but unfortunately in this case, the caterpillar kind of loses out pretty badly, inevitably.
We're speaking with Matt Simon. He's a science writer who writes the Absurd Creature of the Week column for the Wired magazine. He's author of The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Most Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems. It is a very funny, illustrated book with snappy descriptions of some of these absolutely absurd creatures. For a creature to adapt, they are gaining an edge, but that can get quickly canceled out by the edge of another creature. What is an example of that?
Yeah, so this comes across also in parasites. Interestingly, when you get this behavioral manipulation in a little terrestrial isopod that we know as the pill bug, or roly-poly in some regions of the United States, it is invaded by a worm. And when that worm gets in there and starts developing, it actually controls the isopod's brain and kind of moves it out into the sunlight. That might make it more visible to birds where this worm must complete its life cycle. But you get this behavior also in other animals that are driven out into the open by parasites. And that could be descended from this strategy that a lot of parasites have to kind of bake off these parasites. The host will move out into the open, into the sun, and that raises their body temperature. They can handle that, but the parasites within cannot. And a lot of times you'll get a host that can overcome the worms inside of its body just based on temperature alone. So it's called behavioral fever. We have our own fever that's kind of automatic. It kicks in when we get sick. But some insects are actually able to control their body temperature like that to mount some sort of countermeasure against the parasites within.
In many of these cases, it's just not a good end. I mean, many of the creatures we meet in your book have a pretty rough road. Giving pay to this Darwinian principle that nature is red in tooth and claw, you know, indifferent to death and to suffering.
Yes. Yes, yes, there's so much of that. We have a whole section in the book about not getting eaten. That's a big problem for a lot of creatures out there. Again, we have removed ourselves from the food chain. We don't have to worry about that. One particularly interesting solution comes from this creature called the crested rat, which lives in Africa. It has its own predators, of course. It's a little rat and largely helpless as a mammal without any armor or things like that. What it does is it finds a very specific kind of tree with extremely toxic roots. It will chew up those roots and slather it along its side on these special hairs that soak up those toxins. And those hairs are actually colored black and white to kind of grab the attention of predators. So when this thing is under threat, it will actually flash that flank. The predator sees those colors, and ideally what the crested rat is doing is actually inviting this predator to bite on this very specific spot on its body. The predator gets a mouthful of these toxins and then perishes pretty quickly. It's remarkable mostly because how did the crested rat figure out how to do this in the first place? And how does the crested rat not itself perish when all it takes is to get a mouthful of this toxin to die very quickly?
It is so ingenious how these things develop or how they figure out
it really is.
How to hide or to live in weird places like the pearlfish. Tell us about the pearlfish there on the barren sea floor.
Oh, the pearlfish. Yeah, that's a tough one. So on the barren sea floor, you don't have the protection of a reef if you're a fish that you can kind of climb into and hide from your predators. What is available on the barren sea floor is the sea cucumber. The pearlfish is a sort of eel-like fish. It's long and thin, and when it finds a sea cucumber, it sniffs around and it finds its bum. The pearlfish then squirms up said bum and lodges itself in the respiratory tract of the sea cucumber. One of my favorite calculations in all of science that I've come across is a scientist actually went out and calculated how often the pearlfish will go in headfirst versus tailfirst. And it turns out that if you're an adult pearlfish, you're a little bit bigger around the head, you go in tail first because you look a lot like an eel. It's thin in that region. But juveniles will actually go in 80% of the time head first because they're much smaller. And the scientist found this calculation and put it in a paper and actually published it, which is lovely when you think about the editor who went through and okayed that.
Or the person who researched it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, the guy was sitting there on the seafloor watching this with a piece of paper and ticking how many times the pearlfish goes in headfirst versus tailfirst, which is quite the job, really. But when the pearlfish gets in there, it's not exactly behaving itself. It will eat the internal organs of the sea cucumber, including the gonads. So the sea cucumber itself cannot reproduce any longer, which is an extra indignity considering when you get two pearlfish in a sea cucumber, they will mate inside and release their young into the environment. But really, this all comes from a lack of shelter on the seafloor. The sea cucumber has this amazing defense that the pearlfish is exploiting in the sense that it can contract its body and fire its intestines out of its bum, which doesn't sound like a defense at face value, but it does work. It does tend to scare away predators who are not expecting that sort of thing. But oddly enough, the pearlfish doesn't seem to elicit this response when it itself works its way up the sea cucumber. And that might be because of the regenerative powers of the sea cucumber. It can actually regenerate whole organs, like its intestines or gonads. So the sea cucumber might be making a calculation here where they're thinking, okay, I can let this pearlfish in. It's going to be unpleasant. But ideally, they're just going to eat the gonads and leave. I could fire my intestines out. That will take a whole lot longer to actually regenerate, leaving me a little bit weak. So you get these interesting calculations in the animal kingdom.
But we're also reminded that conflict is everywhere. You know, this is part of the world of evolution, that even though we as a species are far less violent than we were 1,000 or even 100 years ago, is there any level of comfort for you, you know, as a human being, as a writer, for us, knowing that adaptation can be ingenious and it's possible?
Part of the reason why Darwin's ideas back in the 19th century were so society-shaking was it because it introduced this concept of a nature that is not in harmony. This isn't about creatures all getting along on Noah's Ark. This is about creatures doing very bad things to each other, all in the pursuit of survival and passing down their genes. I don't find that concerning like a lot of people do. It sounds nihilistic, but it is a very, very beautiful, intricate, and enchanting process, evolution by natural selection. As an organism, you produce more offspring than can possibly survive. That's by design because they're not all going to survive. But you get the ones that are surviving are the ones that are best adapted to their environment. That's what drives evolution. You get these mutations and variation that better suit your offspring for survival. It's a game of chance. And when you think about what the chance of evolution has provided in the animal kingdom, this 3.5 billion year history of life on Earth that produced mammals and insects and things like Antechinus doing weird things to each other, I think it's absolutely majestic. It's really something to be in awe of. And I really hope I did that justice in the book to kind of tease out these particularly interesting concepts in nature that often involve injecting eggs into caterpillars and things like that. But I'm consistently humbled by the fact that evolution has produced the most amazing wonders on the face of planet Earth.
Matt Simon, a science writer at Wired Magazine, thank you very much for speaking with us.
And thank you for having me.
You can find much more on Matt's book, The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Most Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems. There's a link at wordofmathradio.org.